Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books and Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Bert Kritzer, who's the author of Judicial Selection in the States, Politics and the Struggle for Reform. This was published by Cambridge University Press in 2021, I believe, and is a deep dive into the discussion and understanding of how we get state judges. But I'm going to let Bert explain that to us. Welcome to the podcast, Bert, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this particular project. You are very well published, but this is your most recent book.
So I am a faculty member at the University of Minnesota Law School, but I am not a lawyer. I'm a political scientist, taught for 30 years at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and then had the opportunity to join a law school in the Twin Cities. And after a couple of years there, moved over to the University of Minnesota Law School. I've been working on research related to state judicial selection for a number of years. I had published another book a few years ago that looked at the patterns of judicial elections in state Supreme Courts post-World War II. And one of the things that became very apparent in working on that book was the frequency of changes in how judges, state judges are selected, state Supreme Court judges are selected. And that led me into the project that became the Judicial Selection in the States, which is a study of states changing how they select their judges since 1980. That is, I focus on the changes and struggles for change post-1980, albeit in discussing individual states, I often cover earlier efforts to make changes to how the judges in those states are selected.
And as somebody, you know, who looks at, of course, the founding period as setting up the rubrics for things that came later. One of the things you do point out is there wasn't necessarily a lot of clarity about doing this in the first place.
Well, it certainly was left to the states as to how they would do it. This is part of the federal system. And individual states were free to determine how they would select judges. Initially, all states appointed judges, but early on, some states tried judicial elections. And judicial elections rose to prominence from about 1820 to 1860.
And after that period, which, as you note early on in the book, comes with the sort of Jacksonian movement, then there are some switches and changes in how states decided to go about getting their judges. And again, this is not federal. These are not Article III judges. These are all state judges.
Well, there's some discussion in the literature as to what degree was the shift to elections a part of the Jacksonian popular democracy movement. And there's actually significant scholarship that argues that it was driven less by that and more by a desire to increase the independence of judges, independence from other political elites. The interesting challenge was that no one thought through how the candidates for judicial elections would in fact be chosen, which turns out in that period to be prior to primary elections to be done by the same political elites.
And so your focus in the book is obviously not on the Civil War period or even the post-Civil War period, but more or less the post-World War II period. And specifically the period you study is 1980 to 2018, I believe.
Correct.
And so what was going on, or what was the situation in the post-World War II period with regard to how states got their judges? Was there consistency or inconsistency in that?
Well, there's lots of variation in how states were selecting judges. In many states, particularly Northeast states, judges were appointed. They were not elected. In several states, two states in particular, no, three states at the time, some or all judges were elected by the state legislature. In other states, they were selected through partisan elections, where the judges are identified by party on the ballot, the candidates. In other states, they were selected by nonpartisan elections. A small number of states used what are best described as semi-partisan elections, where the parties nominated, but the candidates on the general election ballot appeared without party labels. And then as of the end of World War II, there was one state, Missouri, that had adopted a plan known there as the Nonpartisan Judicial Selection Plan, which involved a system where a nominating commission forwarded potential candidates, or forwarded a list of candidates, to the governor. The governor then would appoint from that list, and the governor was limited to appointing from that list. An appointee would serve a relatively short period of time and then stand in a referendum style election known as a retention election, where voters were asked whether or not the judge should continue in office for a full term. And then at the end of those full terms, the judge could again stand in a retention election. And if the voters said, a majority in Missouri said yes, they would continue in office for another term.
And this Missouri plan is one that you talk about throughout the book, because other states adopted all or part of it as a means of getting their judges. Besides having these sort of various different formats of getting the judge with the nominating commission and the governor appointing from that, and then having these retention elections, what is the idea behind the Missouri plan and these parts of it?
Well, the idea behind it, arguably, is to improve the quality of the judges. And in fact, the proponents of the plan like to label it merit selection. The evidence as to whether or not the judges selected under the Missouri plan or its variants are in any sense better than judges selected in the other methods used in the U.S., there's a lack of support for that argument. But many people still believe it produces better judges. The retention election piece of it was, in a sense, a way of dealing with Americans' love affair with elections. That is, it left some role for the voters directly to have some say regarding who was serving as a judge. It allowed them to basically fire judges. It didn't allow them to select judges.
And so in terms of the Missouri plan, the commission also is the sort of means of getting the merit or the judges that have certain qualifications. And how many other states have decided to go in that direction?
Boy, can I give you a number off the top of my head? No. What I can tell you is quite a few. Missouri adopted it around in the 1940s. The next state to adopt it was Kansas in 1958. And between 1960 and 1980, a number of states adopted it. I could sort of spin off a list of the ones that I can think of, but I don't think that's needed. The last state to adopt it was Utah in 1985. At least the last state where the voters approved it was in Utah in 1985. Tennessee, the legislature adopted it for the state Supreme Court in the 1990s.
So one of the points that your book is making is not only are there different ways of selecting judges, but that states have sort of changed things around at different points in different ways. And that the data that you accumulate in the book is like these different sort of bubbles of activity around how judges are selected. Can you talk a little bit about what you found in terms of these sort of clusters of advocacy for change and also the fact that it didn't always happen?
Well, let me talk about the latter question first. I look at all of the major efforts that were made to change selection systems starting about 1980. And a number of them that I look at in a number of states, the efforts were not successful. There was an effort, for example, here in Minnesota after the White decision on judicial election campaign limitations. But nothing came of that because the problems that people feared have not developed in Minnesota. A number of other states have also attempted unsuccessfully to make changes over the period of time. And usually it's a combination of either lack of support or in some circumstances, the nature of the system for adopting state constitutional amendments can make it more or less difficult to do so. As for the clusters, so as I suggested, there was a cluster of changes to the Missouri plan between 1960 and 1980. Since 1980, probably the most common change has been to nonpartisan elections. Several of those have happened in southern states, Georgia, Mississippi, border states, Kentucky. Florida made such a change actually in the 1970s and then switched to a Missouri plan. More recently, there have been a number of efforts to move to a more political selection system. So there have been several efforts to end at least the role of the nominating commission in states with a Missouri plan. It was done in Tennessee and for the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Kansas. But several other states there have been efforts that were unsuccessful. One state, North Carolina, that had adopted a nonpartisan election system in early 2000s for its state Supreme Court and other courts, has now switched back to partisan elections. Ohio, which had long had a system of the semi-partisan type of judicial selection, has now, just within the last few weeks, shifted to a pure partisan system for the appellate courts. What's one of the arguments I make in the book is that between 1980 and say 1999, the dates are a little fuzzy, that the efforts at change for changing judicial selection seem to be driven more often by what I call legal professionalism, good government kinds of norms. Some of those changes came as part of major overhauls of state constitutions, for example. That was definitely true in Georgia. But since 2000, it's been much more driven by partisan politics, policy kinds of concerns. So in North Carolina, both the shift initially to nonpartisan elections was driven politically, in that case by the Democrats, who were starting to lose control of politics in North Carolina and presumably thought that their Democratic judges would be more secure in a nonpartisan system. And once the Republicans felt they'd taken firm control, they shifted it back to partisan elections because they felt that they would have an advantage under partisan elections. And arguably the change in Ohio that's just occurred reflects the fact that Republicans think having the Republican label on the general election ballot will be to their advantage, particularly in light of the fact that they lost several state Supreme Court elections in the last couple of rounds.
And one of the points that you make also in the course of the book, because you do highlight some of the things that are going on in each of these states that you've been mentioning, is that the sort of process is more complex and subtle. I think those are the words that you use, than one might sort of assume. And it also doesn't necessarily apply across the board to state judges. It may just be the Supreme Court or the appellate courts or the trial courts or all of them, but that the shifts and changes are not necessarily sort of sweeping radically remaking the way that all judges in a state get their jobs. Is that correct?
Well, in some states, it was sort of a radical overhaul. So, for example, in Georgia, virtually all judges went from partisan to nonpartisan. In North Carolina, it came in several stages, initially as in response to some litigation was brought because of some interesting peculiarities of the North Carolina system for selecting the higher level trial court judges. But in other states, you know, there's been important differences between how changes were made for appellate judges, including state Supreme Court, and changes or lack thereof for trial courts. There's been greater incidence of adopting a Missouri plan type system for appellate courts than for trial courts. And there are a number of situations in states where voters had approved a Missouri plan system for the appellate courts, and then were at a later point asked to adopt such a system for trial courts, and they rejected it. In other situations, the legislature has not been willing to bring to the voters proposals for trial court.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in terms of sort of understanding these shifts and changes, as you say, there's a kind of move that happens around 2000 or fuzzily around there that is less about sort of how to get the best judges and more in a partisan direction. And you also sort of contextualize this in the context of these kind of legal and democratic subcultures that are sort of part of what is being responded to by judges and by legislatures who may be changing the way that judges get their jobs. Can you explain about these subcultures and how they operate within the sort of state judicial system?
Well, the idea of these subcultures comes from a book by Richard Richardson and Kim Vines from a long time ago. And Dick Richardson was my thesis advisor, so the arguments that he made in that book is something that have stuck with me and have interested me. The core argument regarding the subcultures is, again, to what degree should courts be tied to the democratic norms in politics, broadly defined, i.e., to what degree should judges at least be somewhat attentive to potential constituencies? To what degree should they take into account, at least in some ways, the politics of the situation? The legal subculture argument is that judges should be independent, should be driven by the norms that are conveyed in legal education in terms of respect for precedent, understanding the text of laws, etc. And they exist side by side. There's no such thing as purely one or purely the other. But it always struck me as kind of an interesting argument. And, you know, I started out a hypothesis that a lot of the changes would be driven by the political subculture. And in particular, one of the things I was curious about is whether I would see in states where the political dominance was shifting, was there a move to shift the kind of system of judicial selection that would be advantageous to either the group that's going out of power, trying to hang on, like in North Carolina, or the group that's coming into power, i.e. the Republicans later in North Carolina. And what I ultimately found is that worked for some states, North Carolina being a good example, but did not work in other states, Georgia being a very good example. I thought Georgia would be a place where I'd see that. I thought Mississippi would be a place where I'd see that. In terms of unsuccessful efforts for change, I thought I might see it in a place like Texas. But no, that I did not see that, nor did I see it in Florida. So what I found was a real mix of the two. And the interesting part was that the dominance of which one was sort of driving what was going on shifted again around 1980. I'm sorry, around 2000.
And in part of the subculture also is this question that you pose as one of accountability to the constituents, the people of the community. And part of it is the role of independence. I mean, and in terms of understanding judges in the federal system, you know, obviously when I teach an intro American government class, we talk about the appointment for life and good behavior. But that's not the case with regard to judges in the states. And so how does that independence work with this idea of accountability in the shifts that you've seen?
Well, but that's obviously the tension between involved in the selection of judges. There are three states, I believe, now that have systems a little bit more like the federal system. The exception for two of the three is that there's a mandatory retirement age. So it's not life, but it's appointed until mandatory retirement. New Jersey has a kind of unique system where judges are initially appointed for a seven-year term. And at the end of 7 years, they can be reappointed or not. If they are reappointed, they then serve until mandatory retirement. It's kind of like a tenure system for academics. Only state that does that. And there's a lot of variation in what the states do. Delaware, there was a recent U.S. Supreme Court case that the court ducked on standing grounds, which was a challenge to provisions that in Delaware that the courts be roughly balanced in terms of the partisan makeup. So, you know, there's this tension between independence and accountability, which is the way it's regularly talked about, is an ongoing one with courts, you know, around the world. To what degree should there be accountability? To what degree? And then also the question is accountability to what or whom, and to what degree should there be judicial independence?
And your book doesn't resolve this question.
I resolve the question, I get the Nobel Prize in political science.
Because there isn't one. But that being the case, you do take us through these three parts in the book in terms of not only the legal subculture side in part two, where you also talk about the role of modernization as part of what some states were pursuing in sort of changing the way that the judges were selected. Can you explain what role modernization plays in all of this?
Well, I mean, court modernization was a major movement mid-20th century. And it involved a lot of pieces. A lot of it had to do with reorganizing courts into more coherent structures where there were, may have been many, many different types of courts. There was what's referred to as court unification, where the courts were structured in a more systematic way. And part of that in some states was rethinking how judges should be selected. And by then there were modern systems, both nonpartisan and Missouri plan. The states that shifted to nonpartisan, most of them at least briefly considered Missouri plan, but there was usually a concern that they would lack political popular support for that because it took judicial selection out of the hands of the electorate, even though in practice, a large number of judges are appointed, even in election states. The paper I'm writing at the present is looking at what percentage or the likelihood that judges, state Supreme Court judges in states where they're ostensibly elected, are in fact initially appointed. That's a paper that I'm trying to get finished now. The idea of modernization was simply, arguably, to make the courts better in broad sense.
And making courts better seems reasonable. But I also wanted to ask you, in terms of the structure of the book itself, you go through part one as more partisan considerations, part two sort of focuses on the legal subculture and this question of modernization. And part three is broadly where the effort was joined but failed. And so in sort of setting out your research, I'm finding that you found some surprises as you were doing the research, like the anticipation that, you know, there would be these changes and then they didn't happen because of a variety of reasons. Can you talk about any parts of the book in general or specifically where you were surprised by what the research sort of brought forward?
I guess I would say I was surprised to a certain degree by what happened in North Carolina in particular, which was a rather bizarre set of things that took place over the last roughly decade. So the Democrats had switched to nonpartisan elections as they felt they were starting to lose some control. When the Republicans took control, I think 2014, I think, is when they won the election that took complete control. They were concerned about maintaining control of the state Supreme Court. And so there was an election for state Supreme Court coming up in 2016. And the Republican legislature and governor tried to shift that election from a nonpartisan election to a retention election, i.e. a referendum on whether or not the one incumbent would be retained in office. The state that was challenged, and it was struck down by a three-judge trial court because it was a constitutional challenge under the state constitution. All three judges who struck it down actually had Republican backgrounds, which was kind of intriguing. It was appealed to the state Supreme Court. The justice involved recused himself. The court tied three Republicans and three Democrats. And so the trial court decision stood, and it became a contested and unpartisan election. But it goes beyond that, okay? So the Republicans also were trying to facilitate Republican control of intermediate appellate court in North Carolina. And to do that, they passed a law that the first law made the listing of party identification of a candidate in the Intermediate Court of Appeals election would be listed on the ballot. But they also then made a change that the candidates of the party of the governor would be listed first on the ballot, okay? So the Republican candidates would be listed first, and Democrat and other party candidates would follow. The election comes along, and the Democratic candidate for state Supreme Court wins. I hypothesize, I only can speculate on this, that the reason that the Democratic candidate won was that for the Supreme Court election, the ballot position was determined by lot, and the Democratic candidate was listed first. So I speculate that at least enough voters assumed that the first listed candidate was the Republican, that the Democrat, who was in fact the first listed candidate, won that election. So by manipulating the Court of Appeals election, the Republican-controlled legislature and governor set up the victory of the Democratic candidate. 2 years later, let me finish this. 2 years later, the Republicans decided to not have primary elections for the state Supreme Court. And, you know, any candidate that got enough petition would run. There was a Republican incumbent, again, up for election. I think it was an incumbent. And the Republicans speculated that there would be multiple Democratic candidates on the ballot and just the one Republican. But at the last minute, a second Republican got on the ballot and split the Republican vote and the Democrat won.
And so in the North Carolina case, there's a lot of sort of mushing around what was going on to try to advantage the Republican candidates by the Republican legislature and the Republican governor, I assume. But in the end, it didn't work.
Right. Because of how they tried to do it.
Is there another example where such a sort of pursuit was taken and it worked better for the people involved?
Well, we will get to see in Ohio, okay, where they have now shifted fully partisan, whether or not the Republican candidates for the appellate courts will be more successful. The Republicans had pretty extensive control of the courts, and they still technically may have control of the state Supreme Court. I forget what the split is, but they've been losing ground. And so it will be interesting to see what happens, you know, in 2022. I don't know how many candidates or how many justices are up in Ohio at that point. See what transpires. I should note that it's not just the Republicans that play this game. The Democrats in Ohio early in the 2010, filed a lawsuit attempting to argue that it was a violation of freedom of association, denying the listing of, given that candidates were being nominated by the parties, that they were not being listed with party labels on the general election ballot. At that point, the Democrats were being more successful in the state elections. And so they were trying to try to advance their advantage. That case was unsuccessful. They did not succeed in making getting the courts to strike down that provision of Ohio law.
In your research,
that generally, you know, and this is something that I'm seeing in the new study on litigation over judicial selection, is that generally efforts to strike down how states are selecting judges have been unsuccessful. The one kind of exception was, again, a situation in North Carolina where they were nominating judges by district for a trial court, but electing them statewide, which meant that there could be a Republican, you know, North Carolina politically has long had sort of regions, and some regions were more Republican, some were more Democrat, going back a long time. But the system basically denied the ability of Republicans to elect judges of the higher trial court in North Carolina. And litigation was brought on that matter.
And I wanted to ask a broader regional question in terms of what the data also indicated. Is there a difference in regions of the country with regard to how they operate and how they think about judges and the selection or election of judges? Did you find regional distinctions?
Well, historically, there have been regional distinctions. So historically, the states that came into the country early, the Northeast, have retained appointive systems. I'm thinking of the original 13 states. I think the only two that were using popular elections were Pennsylvania and Georgia. All of the others used some kind of elite selection. Virginia and South Carolina, legislative appointment. One of the New England state, I think it was Rhode Island, was using legislative election for the state Supreme Court, but not for the trial courts. At least with regard, New York actually did have, it was, New York did have judicial elections for its appellate courts. It still has it for its trial courts. But it is the only state in modern times that has ended any form of popular election for any of the major courts. And so in the 1970s, they ended popular elections for the appellate courts in New York. But it's unique in that regard. Other areas of the country, the South was long held on to partisan elections, and still several of the states using partisan elections are in the South. Though recently Arkansas shifted from partisan to nonpartisan. The Midwest and West has been a mix of, for a long time, a mix of Missouri Plan and nonpartisan elections. Exception in terms of nonpartisan elections currently would be New Mexico. And the only state west of the Mississippi that does not use elections in any way is Hawaii.
And what is unique about Hawaii's process?
Hawaii has a system of appointment and reappointment. It's not unique compared to some states in other states. Just it's unique in being the only state west of the Mississippi that does not and has never used popular elections of any type.
And so in terms of how you went around about sort of pulling all of this together, your book includes data and interviews, or the interviews are part of the data. How did you design the kind of sort of methodology to get this information?
Well, I'd say the dominant methodology was looking through newspapers, using newspapers as sources. In the case of several states, there were key players who I was able to make contact with. So, for example, Georgia, where the system was part of a larger constitutional overhaul. I was the man who was essentially the executive director of that was available, as was at least one other person. And so I was able to make contact with him and talk to him, although he pointed me, it turned out that many of the documents from that commission were available electronically. So I was able to access some of those. Similarly, it was similar in Utah, I believe, where there was a good source. Some of the people I talked to were political scientists who'd been around at the Dulon courts, who'd been around at the time. When I couldn't find something or when I thought I might be able to get some additional information, I would try to figure out somebody to contact.
Yeah, as I was reading through, I think, the preface, and I saw your listing of the people, I was wondering, in certain senses, who everybody was.
Right. And I thought I listed their affiliation.
You did list affiliation, and then there were people who didn't have affiliations, and so those were the ones that I was sort of like, who are they?
Let's see who those are. I don't remember. I have to look at the intro and see who those are, the preface.
I was fascinated by the sort of particular stories of some of the states like Utah that you talk about and like Mississippi, because they didn't do exactly what I thought that they would be doing.
Well, that was certainly true of Mississippi to me. It was, albeit, there was some issues that were brought under the Civil Rights. There was some litigation brought under the Civil Rights Act, but that dealt more with the trial courts than it did with the state Supreme Court.
And you already mentioned that you're working on a paper that is somewhat connected to this, but are you working on another book that sort of extends this research?
Well, again, the project on litigation over judicial selection, I've had research assistants for the last 18 months. working their way through the states, trying to locate litigation related to judicial selection and preparing memos. And there is only one state left to finish as of now, which is good because the research assistant who's doing it is going off to the military at the end of the summer, having finished her JD. And, you know, I have sort of in my mind a potential outline for a book, and I actually started an intro chapter early in the summer, late in the spring, but then I've gotten diverted by another paper, again, related. I mentioned that the frequency of appointment rather than selection. And so I spent a lot of time over the last month working on that.
Well, I hope when the next book comes out, you'll come on the New Books Network and talk to me about it. We can continue the conversation. I want to thank Herbert Kritzer for joining me today to talk about judicial selection in the States, politics, and the struggle for reform, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. I assume one can purchase this at Cambridge University Press's website. Is there a brick and mortar store with an online presence you would like to give a shout out to?
Not really.
Okay.
I haven't been in a brick and mortar store for a while.
We'll just send people to Cambridge University Press's website then. Thank you so much for joining me today, Bert. It's been a pleasure.